This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power, and welcome to The Q Interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio. I've been told to stop calling it a show and continue to call it a podcast. I'm 34. Apparently, it's 1983 to me, and I have feathered hair, and I'm going to join Hall & Oates. Today on the show, I'm excited you tuned into this one because this is one of my favorite conversations I've had on Q. I think of all time. Harvey Fierstein is a legend of Broadway. He's been in some incredible movies. He's been in some incredible TV shows. But really what he is a groundbreaker, in particular for gay representation on Broadway. And we play this. I'll tell you how groundbreaking he was. Is we play this clip in the interview for him where Barbara Walters, the interviewer, says to him, I'm not going to spoil it, but essentially she just asks, you know, what is it like being gay at all? And it's on YouTube and it's gone viral under the clip. Like Harvey Fierstein explains homosexuality to Barbara Walters. So, I mean, he has this new memoir where he talks about, I think he talks about the human cost of being groundbreaking. But he would tell you that the book is about sex and violence and drugs because that's what sells, which he says to me over and over again. And we had a grand time going back and forth. So that's coming up. You'll also know if you've been listening to the radio show at all or you heard last week's podcast, you would have heard us call out for your questions or comments for me to respond to you on the show. And here to read a letter or an email or a tweet is Q producer Caitlin Swan. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi.
How are you?
Not too shabby. How you doing?
This was your idea.
This is my brain baby. Yeah.
Caitlin is the producer of, in addition to being one of the producers, great producers on the show, she is also the producer of this here podcast.
This here podcast. We shouldn't change the name to that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to start wearing a barrel with straps and saying, you know, hey, welcome to this here podcast.
I think we have it in the budget.
I don't even know whose voice that is.
No. That was completely made up.
So you have what? A letter?
I have an email? Letter. An email.
Carrier pigeon?
Not a letter. Not a carrier pigeon. Maybe next time as the word gets out. But I have a – yeah, we're kicking it old school with an email. This one – should we do names? No names for now, hey?
You know what? We won't do names. But if you do write us – let us know if you want us to put your name in.
Or where you're from.
Or where you're from.
That's fun.
Yeah.
So this is from Anonymous at the moment. It says, hello, Tom. Good start. I really enjoy listening to Q and the variety of interviews you give. You are so genuine and knowledgeable. Yeah. Strangely enough, though, I don't know who else to ask this question.
Oh.
Even though you interview actors, this kind of inquiry might not be something you get involved in. With regards to props in TV and movies, I feel very strongly about the unrealistic portrayal of actors drinking from paper coffee cups. I know, this seems very trivial, but it takes away from any scene where that kind of prop is used. Are you following so far?
Yeah, I'm with you so far.
Okay. Specifically, when actors carry and handle a cup, they do so as if it's empty.
Is this person from like the paper cup like advocacy group?
They might be. They're lucky they're anonymous right now.
Right.
So they act as if it's empty, which it is, but they aren't even acting like it has liquid in it. Also, when an actor takes a sip of their hot drink, they tip it right up and take a huge gulp as if it's not at all hot.
Are you taking up a second page here? How long is this letter?
It's going to end. It's going to end. And it's large font. Just so you know, there's lots of exclamation marks. This person is passionate about this topic.
Okay.
My suggestion is to fill the cup at least half full of water. Then the handling and drinking of the coffee will at least look realistic. I know I cannot be the only fan of film who notices and cares about such things. But like I said, I don't know where to go or whom to contact. Can you help me, please? Thanks for your time, Anonymous.
Well, I'll tell you, you picked the right person because this is...
As our first listener mail or
second? Yeah, this is, you know, I am in touch with the Canadian acting body about particularly their beverages.
As I figured.
And I don't know how they guessed it, but they got it right. I kind of know what you mean. The other day I was watching Seinfeld and Kramer was taking shots. He was pretending to get, well, I guess he was getting drunk on Seinfeld because I'm with it. I watch all the cool new shows.
Sure, watching, yes. Cutting edge, this guy.
Thank you. And... I did notice that he was tilting it back a little too fast. It didn't seem realistic to me. You know what? I think we can probably do something about this.
What? I think it's within our power.
Yeah, it is not. And I can't do much about it. But I appreciate you letting me know And I'll keep it in mind. And maybe it'll ruin every movie for me from now on.
You know, it's kind of fun that they wanted to go to you with this. I'm glad they did, because you are clearly an expert.
Well, you know, as someone who's talked to a lot of people who have drank in films, I guess that does make me a little bit of an expert. Thank you for the letter.
You're welcome.
If people want to send more questions, whether it's about drinking in films or not, how do they do that?
Q@cbc.ca, the old email, or...
Yeah, that's probably the best
way
to do it.
Do it there.
Yeah.
We all got an email, right?
Q@cbc.ca.
The show, or carrier pigeon.
The show, yeah, if you want to send a carrier pigeon, but we get to keep the pigeon. We're on Instagram @cbcq. I'm on there as Tom Joe Power. Harvey Fierstein's new memoir is called I Was Better Last Night. Here is my conversation with Harvey Fierstein. Harvey, welcome to the show. How are you?
I am very good. I am so good. I'm so good.
Why are you so good?
You know, you sit and you write for a year or whatever it took to write it, probably not a year, but in COVID, everything felt like a year. You just, you know, but you're by yourself. It's you. And you know, and it's not even like writing a play where eventually you're going to share that and other people are going to come into it. You know what I mean? It's you. It's you. And you're not hiding behind characters, and I'm not trying to disappear. You know, most of my writing being for the theater, the last thing you want to hear is from me. You want to hear the characters speak. So I'm constantly making sure that I'm not in the picture, that it's the character speaking or whatever. And now all of a sudden it's me, and I'm being as honest as I can and trying to make you feel that you are with me, and I'm speaking to you directly, and we're having this conversation, and you're telling stories that you probably haven't even told very close friends of yours.
Yeah.
But some friends know this, and some other friends didn't. That's why you keep your friends separate, right? Because you tell one and the other. It's like nobody really knows.
Two group chats. I know what you mean.
Absolutely, and nobody even knows my real name or my identity. I'd have to tell them, obviously, or my real age. Look in the internet. I have like 50 different ages. And so all of a sudden you put all of this stuff out and now it's there. And if somebody says, yeah, but you blah, 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 you say, that's not true. Well, I read it in your book. So it's very naked.
Yeah.
Very naked. And I didn't let a lot of people read it, even when I was done. My editor read it, and I had a couple of friends that I trust that I let read it, but most of my friends I didn't. In fact, I just handed two friends just left my house. I just handed them the book the first time. A lot of people. So, anyway, so why am I good? People are loving it. It's unbelievable that they're, you know, it's really a good feeling, and it's amazing.
I absolutely loved reading it. I mean, I got so much from it. I'm hoping we can go through some of our favorite stories from the book and a little bit about your sort of journey throughout the book. And I kind of want to start right here, which I think is what your stage debut was. And I'll read from the book for a second. I was given the largest role in Sleeping Beauty because I was generally perceived as having the most theatrical flair in class 2-1 of PS 186 in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. What was the role?
I played the king in Sleeping Beauty. I didn't want to play the king in Sleeping Beauty. I wanted to play the evil witch because she got to have green skin. She got to have red lips. She had Philomena had these. We got these plastic nails at the five, you know, the five and dime. I mean, it was a penny candy store. So she had these long black nails. And that's what I wanted. And she had the big hat and all that. I don't want to play the king. So anyway, I wrote that story first when I decided to write the book. And I took that story and I sent it to Philomena.
Oh, yeah. Like your co-star in Sleeping Beauty.
The girl. We've been friends since kindergarten. We're still friends now.
Yeah.
We're both, you know, I'm going to be 70 in June. Mm-hmm. So we're very old people now. But we've known each other since we're 5 years old. And so I sent it to her. She didn't even answer it with words. She sent back that photograph that's in the book of me at 7 years old in drag. She took that picture and sent it to me. And I said, if that day and that experience meant that much to Philomena, at least it means something to somebody else. I'll go ahead and finish writing the book.
I mean, what a trip. I mean, like, you guys have stayed friends and everything, but to hear back with such specificity about that little moment in your life.
Oh, please. And unfortunately, well, when you write a book like this, I have to say the really hard part is after you finish writing the book, you can't close the spigot. That spigot's been open and all the memories keep coming and they keep coming and they keep coming, which is why I think Shirley MacLaine's written like 9 autobiographies. But
there's no escaping it now. What theater was your family taking you to see when you were a kid?
We saw everything. My mother loved culture. I mean, she loved theater, but she loved culture. So we saw her. She took us to museums. She took us to the ballet when the very first time that the Royal Shakespeare Company came to America, we were there. We saw everything. There was a magazine called Q, which has become New York Magazine, and it had the listings of everything coming up in the city, all the movies. It had the TV listings. It had the theater. And she would look what's coming in theater and sit down and mail order, no internet, mail order tickets to every new show. You could buy tickets in the first row of the mezzanine, which is now called the mezzanine. We called it the balcony then, because it costs more if you call it the mezzanine.
And the mezzanine is the balcony? That's the same thing?
They messed it up. Oh, have they messed it up?
I've often wondered what the mezzanine is. Anyway, go on.
You easy. Yeah. It's like I'm reaching the mezzanine and I always end up on the wrong level. But she would buy the dead center, the very first row. So it was like the show was being put on for you. It was like it was there. And those tickets back then were $2.50, $3 a ticket. Our family, who didn't have much money, could see a Broadway show for $10 plus the dollar, because the subway was 15 cents then during the Depression. And, I'm that old. No.
you had a bindle and you would come up on the road. You would ride the rails on one of those old timey.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we just walked from Brooklyn. It was just, we walked across the Brooklyn Bridge every time. But we would come up, through the subway for 15 cents each. So 60 cents for that. We would eat lunch at Rossoff's. It was a restaurant called Rossoff's that was painted a sort of Tiffany-ish blue. It was more blue than Tiffany, but it was a Russian restaurant, which meant it was kosher. And we'd have the chopped steak, which was hamburger, and see a Broadway show. So we saw everything, whether it was appropriate for children or not.
I mean, what incredible access! I mean, so much has changed there, right?
So much has changed there. Well, I mean, $400, those tickets are $200 now.
Yeah.
Instead of $2.50. Yeah. And the subway is, I don't even know what the subway is now. It's $2.50, $3. I don't even know.
I mean, so, and then you end up acting and you end up getting involved in community theater. And I love the story that you read your first review and you write in the book, it's my first review and it's a rave. And you're reading it over and over again, this first review, and you're trying to read the review so that you're surprised every time your own part gets mentioned. And then, I guess out of the corner of your eye or somewhere on the page, you see this other casting notice and...
Wait. I wasn't in the theater yet. I was in community
theater. Yeah, community theater.
This was a little community theater in a church, that we're doing for fun. I never wanted to be an actor. I never wanted to be a writer. This was something I was sort of doing because it was fun. My best friend, Michael, was doing it. So if Michael was doing it, I was doing it because he was the alpha. I was definitely the sidekick and playing this role. And we had done, like you just said, I got this great review in this New York newspaper. It was a theater newspaper. And when I went to tear it out, on the back of the review was a casting notice for Andy Warhol's play, Pork. I was an art student. That's what I was. I was not, I wasn't of the theater. I was going to be a painter or a sculptor or something like that. I wasn't very good. But that didn't matter. There's a lot of really bad artists. I don't know if you've ever noticed.
I know a couple of them.
And they make a lot of money too.
Yeah, you're right.
I wanted to meet Warhol. Now, I wasn't so in love with his pop art yet.
The soup cans and all that wasn't your thing.
No, to me that just felt very commercial. But I loved his real commercial art. I loved his He used to draw for Macy's and for Bloomingdale's shoe ads. I loved his illustrations. I loved his drawings. I loved that stuff that he was doing on the side. This commercial art, I thought he was absolutely brilliant. So to meet Andy Warhol, I said, wait a second. It's an audition for a play. I'm a kind of actor. I mean, I'm in a play. I could take the review with me. And so I ran home. Well, my friend Irene Stein, we are art students. So she had a camera and I had a dark room. And so she took a picture of me and I blew it up to an 8x10, which I knew that's what actors had to have, was an 8x10. And then I wrote out my resume. I just took the stuff from community theater, you know, and just put in really, you know, spaced out. We couldn't be large letters about it. We didn't have computers. I mean, I'm typing, you know, one finger at a time. As a dyslexic kid, I can't even type more than one finger. And I staple it together and I go in search of this thing called La Mama, you know, Vev Ace to this kid from Brooklyn. What the hell's La Mama?
Yeah, that's the famous New York experimental theater La Mama.
And all of a sudden, my life changed.
All of a sudden, your life changed is so real, Hervey, because there's one thing I get from that part of the book is that these small little moments, like you seeing a casting notice for an Andy Warhol play on the other side of a page you were ripping out, I don't know if we'd be here talking.
Oh, absolutely not. But that's the way life is. And I try and tell people that all the time and they think I'm being overdramatic or it only happens to you or it only happens in the movies or whatever. But all day long, people are asking you questions. It's just the way the world is. You and I are sitting here now. Somebody might text you while, you know, let's have lunch later. And you say, no, I'm going to edit this thing of Harvey's. It's not comfortable. Well, if you stay and edit, yeah, you'll get the editing done. But if you go to lunch, you don't know what's going to happen at lunch. Maybe nothing will happen. Maybe you'll get food poisoning. Maybe you'll spend the afternoon shitting in the toilet. Who knows? But the point is, nothing changes unless you say yes. And the yeses can be the dumbest things in the world. Like, I wanted to meet Andy Warhol. I don't want to be an actor. I got cast in Andy Warhol's play. Never got to meet Andy Warhol until almost the opening of the show, because he wasn't going to hang around with a bunch of loser experimental theater actors. So we did finally meet him. But my whole life, all of a sudden, I was a part of experimental theater.
Yeah.
And it turned, and that wasn't really, and they weren't there to go to Broadway. It's different than it is now. Now a lot of non-commercial theater, they're in it because they want to get to Broadway or they want to become movie stars or whatever. We were in it, at least it felt to me, to be artists. We were there to do something no one else was doing. We were the underground. We were, and I was part of this movement. And I was going to school full time. So I'd be in art school. My teacher was lecturing us about Ray Johnson creating this new art movement called male art. And I was spending my evening having dinner with Ray Johnson at the Pink Teacup on Christopher Street. It was, on Bleecker Street. So it was, I was living this, well, three-way life, but it was because I was this nice Jewish boy at home. Then I was a student during the day. And then I was in the experimental theater and art scene. So it was a very exciting time without an aim to make a career of it. I wanted to live a life as an artist. It was closest to what I imagined in my imaginings, what you know, Paris was like, in the days of Renoir and then Modigliani, of these people that were just making art, and it was exciting and wonderful.
More of my conversation with Harvey Fierstein coming up after this. Hope you enjoyed that chat, or hope you enjoyed that product or service or album or dog walking platform. More of my conversation with Harvey Fierstein starts now. So in this experimental theater world, you end up writing the three plays that become Torch Song Trilogy. And that tells the story of Arnold Beckoff, an out gay man who's also a drag queen. And you cast in the show this woman who's just hanging around your shows all the time. Her name's Estelle Gettleman, and you cast her to play your mother. Torch Song Trilogy becomes such a huge hit that it opens on Broadway in 1982. Estelle Gettleman, who's still playing your mom, changes her name to Estelle Getty, who we would know as Sophia on The Golden Girls. Torch Song Trilogy becomes a massive hit on Broadway. And then, well, I want you to take a listen to this.
We started in the basement of La Mama with one-act plays. The Glines, the only theater in America that would put this show on. They mortgaged an oriental rug in their living room to do it. We opened for an 8-week limited engagement, could not give a ticket away for 3 weeks. Here we are tonight.
It's Harvey Fierstein accepting the Tony Award for Best Play in 1983 for Torch Song Trilogy. And the La Mama you referenced there is the La Mama you referenced earlier, the experimental theater.
Wait. Before you even go on, I have to put this in perspective.
Go ahead.
Something you may not even understand, but it'll help you understand me.
Okay.
That was the first time I've heard that in probably 50 years, or 40 years, whatever. I've not heard that. I've never played it. I've seen it go by, you know, on YouTube or whatever, these things. But I don't go back that way. And look at that stuff or whatever. So you just played something for me that I have probably not heard since the night I said it.
And
it's true. I mean,
how was that for you listening to it just then? How was it?
I'm not comfortable looking at myself as other people see me. I'm comfortable in being in my own skin. But I will tell you that the words coming out of my mouth were absolutely true. They did mortgage their oriental rug. They did get to pay for it. And they did get their money back. And it was all very magical and all that. But as far as me listening to myself or looking at myself in that perspective, what was that old day? Oh God, you're so young. There was a TV show called This Is Your Life.
This Is Your Life.
They sit you down and then they have voices talk from the back. And that's what it was like. It's like a moment from This Is Your Life, Harvey Fierstein. And then any second you're going to dig up Estelle Getty. Well, if she may be dead. She may be dead. But if you call her agent and make her the right offer, she will be there. I know actors, Tom. I know actors. You make her the right offer and she will be there. She is a pro.
I got a question. I got a question. It's a good way to, good attitude towards booking guests. You know, that's all I got to do. Let me ask you this. When you
want Orson Welles, we'll get you Orson Welles.
I'm becoming Orson Welles, I think. When you...
Look, I think that's why I said it.
Maybe, if you do the Citizen Kane reboot, I'm in.
The musical. The score by Cyndi Lauper. she called like a minute before you came online. She just called me. She wanted to know if I could get her the book because I mailed her the book, right? And so she got it. She said, Harvey, could you get me the book so I can have it on my iPad? Because otherwise I got to read it with a flashlight. And I come to it. Could you get it like on the...
Citizen Kane, the musical, the Hearst.
I'm trying to throw you off your game.
The Hearst cut is the deepest.
Oh, no.
Okay. When you go from the basement to Broadway, what do you take with you and what do you lose along the way?
I mean, you try not to lose yourself. You work really hard to not. I lost a lover. but that, you know, men... impossible to live with. The lover of that time, when we got together, we were both actors, but he had a paying job. He could type, and he typed really fast. And he had a daytime job working temporary jobs, and he made a really nice money. I was like $15 a week unemployment. I mean, I had nothing. So when we got together, he was the breadwinner of the family or whatever. Within a year and a half, everything had so shifted. All of a sudden, I'm getting famous and all that. I'm making real money. He can't get a job as an actor. He's working temp jobs. It affected the relationship. And he could not take that adjustment at all.
But like, what happens to you when you say, like, I wanted to be an artist, an artist, an artist, an artist, and then money and fame and all that starts coming in? That got to change things a little bit.
Not if you don't let it.
Really?
I mean, I kept doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I let Torch Song move to Broadway so it would close. I mean, you read the book, Cookie. You're supposed to know this stuff.
I'm asking questions for those who haven't.
For those who haven't read it,
you know.
There's a lot of, just tell me, a lot of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and violence. Violence. Violence sells books. A lot of sex, drugs, rock and roll, violence, and famous people in the book. But the play was running off Broadway, and we were this big hit. And I came out of the subway one day, and there was a line from the box office all the way around the corner waiting to buy tickets, when people used to stand in line to buy tickets. And I saw that line, and I freaked. I said, this thing's a hit. I'm going to be stuck here forever. And I was just finishing writing my play, Spook House, and I wanted to go put that on. And I was also writing La Cage Folle at the time. And I said, I can't be stuck in this forever. And we had all these people that wanted to move it to Broadway. And I said, you know what? I'll let it move to Broadway where it'll flop. I said, this is not going to make it on Broadway. A guy standing, getting a hoot and all that on there, it's not going to work. So I said, so we'll move the show to Broadway. I'll have a nice Broadway credit, you know, look good on the resume, and the show will close and I can go on with my life. But if we leave the show downtown, it's going to run forever. I'm going to be stuck here. So I didn't move the show to become rich and famous. I moved the show to get the hell out of there. And shows you how what a good judge I am for what works and what doesn't.
Oh, yeah. So
because the show then ran for 5 years.
when you did, you mentioned Le Cage aux Folles. What was at the heart of the story that you wanted to tell when you took that on?
It's a simple story. It's a man trying to keep the son from his first marriage and his new wife from killing each other. It's as simple as that. Everything else is in the specifics, but in human terms, that's what it is. Then you add all the color, being that that the boy is engaged to the daughter of a religious bigot, and that the father's new wife is a man, and he's actually gay.
Even the dead of winter can feel like July.
So full of charm for a straight kid.
We start.
And the son doesn't want them to find out he's gay, and the drag queen is too proud of himself to hide. And you have all those specifics, but the story is as human as the story could possibly be.
I wanted to play. So that show opens, you become even more famous and you become that sort of like nationally known famous. I wanted to talk about the Barbara Walters interview just for a second, but I got a feeling But if you didn't want to hear your speech.
The Barbara Walters interview I hear all the time because everyone asks about it.
Let me introduce you to me. My name is everyone. So Barbara is...
And everyone will be playing the role of...
So Barbara's asking you about the story of La Cage aux Folles. This is almost feels like it needs a bit of a warning here, because she's very confused about the whole idea of being gay.
You can have a homosexual couple who love each other, who can live together for years and years, who can have commitment, who can have all the things that we have come to think of as only heterosexual property.
Right. Well, those are not heterosexual experiences, and those are not heterosexual words. Those are human words. Love, commitment, family, belong to all people.
So that's my guest, Harvey Fierstein, being interviewed by Barbara Walters in 1983. People online have called it the moment where Harvey Fierstein explains homosexuality. What I want to talk about is in the book... You explain the moment, you explain how you felt in the moment, but then I can tell you've done a lot of contemplation about how that could have been shown on TV, what Barbara could have done in that moment, and it feels like you got somewhere different with it. Can you talk to me about that?
Oh, there's a lot of unloading to do in those few moments. First of all, we were friends. We already knew each other. She obviously knew other gay people because I met her through this pair of lesbians that we'd have dinner.
Yeah.
We, you know, and all of a sudden I sit down with this woman that I think of as a friend, and she talks to me like I'm from another planet. What your audience can't see, because you're not on TV, is the size of my eyes. I mean, if she asks me these questions, my eyes just open up like, what happened to my friend Barbara? Who is it in there? Who's this? And then I realized I'm on television, or we're on television, and she's giving me this unbelievable chance to explain that which doesn't need explanation, but that which does need explanation. I mean, I sort of understood the moment on some level, so I tried my very best to explain as clearly as I could, though I was very thrown off. And I might have explained it differently another time. But life goes on. The important thing to take from it, which I really don't even talk about in the book, is the thousands of letters that I've gotten from that day, which is 1983, I think, to this. So that's 40 years later. Thousands of letters from kids who saw that interview. You know, because of YouTube, it has never gone off. The other day, we looked just to see how many hits were on that, on one particular copy of it. And there were 250,000 hits on that one particular copy. So who knows over the 40 years how many people have watched it. And I get letters from people living in small towns or living in a family, knowing what they know. And they saw that and it changed their lives, and it opened the world up for them, and it allowed them to be. So Barbara, me, in this awkward thing, changed many lives. I'm not responsible for it. She's not. It's been a funny way. It's what the world can do.
I got another life-changing moment I want to play in just a second. But before I get to that, you know, one of the parts of the book that really...
besides life-changing moments, I hope we get to some sex violence. I'm trying to sell books here, kid.
Listen, I got... Listen, does Orson Welles know how to sell a book? I know how to sell a book. One of the chapters that really stuck out to me while I was reading was the way you wrote about when AIDS hit, and you write about AIDS slamming into us like a tsunami. And this was happening at the same time that your star was rising so fast. You put gay characters in the center of your own stories with Torch Song and La Cage, and they took over Broadway. These two realities you were living with at the same time, I guess, what was that like to live those two simultaneously?
When AIDS hit, we had to just stay alive, and we had to keep our friends alive, and we had so much negotiating to do. We were starting to figure out, because we didn't have any help. We didn't have the government. We had a president who didn't say the word AIDS for 4 years. We had Anthony Fauci, who we were never sure was, he was a young man at that time. We were never sure he was a friend or a foe. We didn't have the government behind us. The government knew that this disease was not going to be easily cured and not have an answer. So don't take it on. It's a losing political position, as Democrats will tell you right now. They took on COVID and it's done nothing but harm to them. Whereas Donald Trump made believe, you know, did all this nonsense while he took the shots, and he's the hero. We had the same kind of nonsense going on with AIDS. We had the same political battles in our small world. And it was very difficult to just try and put the right face. And I was on, I talk about it in the book. I was on, Ted Koppel had a show, a late night show that's became whatever it became, you know, after he left it.
Nightline or something like that.
Yeah, Nightline. And I was on with all these politicians. And I remember Dan Ammeyer, what a prick he was. And he was just, you know, we should lock all homosexuals. They were talking about creating an island to put homosexuals on.
Yeah.
People were losing their jobs as waiters in restaurants because straight people didn't want to go to restaurants and get AIDS.
People wouldn't sit next to you on talk shows.
Well, that's a kind of fun story, not fun story, but a real story, Ginger Rogers. But I'm saying you're asking me what it was like rising up in the world. Well, I'm saying I was trying to keep my people alive.
Yeah.
I was trying to keep my friends alive. I'm going and I'm lying in a bed at St. Vincent's Hospital, lying next to a friend who's taking his last breaths and telling him it's okay to die. It's okay. Go ahead and die. It's okay. It'll be all right. I'm being banned. We went through a period where they wrapped us in plastic to be able to go in with your loved one, or where we had to talk to them through a glass window, you know. And I watched, like I said, I watched this COVID stuff, and it's just, it's a horrible reminder, and yet they learned nothing.
Can I play you another clip?
Oh my God. What is this? Queen for a day. I'm telling you, it's Queen for a day.
Let me play it for you anyway. I'm doing it.
Somebody stole my car.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, my ex-lover. First he stole my heart, then he stole my car.
He? Aren't you supposed to be Rebecca's old flame?
Well, I'm not that old.
You weren't expecting that one, were you? Because you know how I know?
Because I didn't even know what it was.
do you want to say what it was?
It was Cheers. My Emmy-nominated performance at Cheers. Sherry Steinkellner and her husband were very dear people. We still are in contact anyway. They wrote that for me to be on Cheers, and that was a lot of fun.
A friend of mine told me that was the first time they had ever seen a gay person on TV that wasn't a punchline to them.
I guess I was doing a lot of that stuff then. I was the first gay cartoon character. You know, I kissed Homer Simpson. I was his, when Homer grew hair, I was his secretary. I was his executive secretary, became an executive, and I was executive secretary. And I grabbed him and kissed him, telling him he was smart or whatever. You're good enough. And I gave him a big kiss.
No, I can't. I'm just a big fool.
Oh, no, you're not.
How do you know?
Because my mother taught me never to kiss a fool.
Carl.
Now go get him, Tiger.
I know that episode. I didn't know that was... Did I miss... Is that in the book? Did I miss that in the book?
I don't know. Not everything's in the book. I had to save some stuff for the movie.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Sorry. So when you have all these first...
I did a lot of that crap. I mean, as it turned out, I mean, there were plenty of gay people around me, but I did a lot of those, what we would call firsts. I also turned down a lot of work because I didn't want to be that. I didn't want gay people seen that way. You know, the character It, you know, that clown It.
Yeah.
Stephen King said, I turned that down because I didn't want this open. I said I would play it as an actor and I'd have a great time. But I didn't want an openly gay man eating children. I said, you know, the religious right will take me out of context, will take that character and say, see what they're like, see what homosexuals are like. So I didn't play that role.
But what was, do you feel like a weight of responsibility to represent an entire community?
No, you can't ever do that. No, you can't do that. But I did feel a representation, a weight of at least being the best I could be and putting forth the best. So no, I would not play a character that ate children in a movie. And I always made it really clear, especially in those early days, that I speak only for me. I don't represent anyone. Because you can't represent the gay community. It's just too big.
Yeah. Can you tell me the story of how the kiss in Le Cage aux Folles develops at the same time as sort of the change in...
There's several stories in the book about the kiss in Le Cage aux Folles. So which one? Don't be cute, baby.
There's a moment you keep going back in the memoir. It happens at the end of Le Cage aux Folles. You wrote a kiss between the two main characters. And when you describe the productions of the play over the decades, I'm looking at my notes now, which I've been trying not to do. It's kind of like it felt like the kiss throughout the productions represents the change in representation of gay people. That's what
you're
I want to ask.
Absolutely right. Yes, you have a very good question. There's sex in it. There's no murder. There's no mystery, but there is sex in it, and there is celebrities in it. I'll get some celebrities.
I got you.
Okay, so the very first production of Lacage, I write the end of the show, and obviously that's a happy ending. And the ending of the show is this gay couple. They've sent their son off to be married. The bigots have been embarrassed and sent off, you know, looking like fools. And the gay couples are left alone on the stage. And the, you know, and the designer had the, you know, sunset and all this stuff. And they were going to walk off into the sunset, the two of them in these beautiful match suits. And I said, you know, they take hands and they kiss, and then they turn and they walk up stage as the music swells or whatever. Well, Arthur Lawrence, who directed the show, openly gay in his way, in that 1950s kind of openly gay way, said no, he would not stage it with a kiss. And I said, you know, and he called me all kinds of names. We called each other all kinds of names, but he said, this is enough. You know, why turn the audience off at that moment or whatever? I don't even remember it, but it's in the book. The next production, which Jerry Zaks did, I don't think they kissed in that one either. Although the two of them were both, oh, and they were heterosexuals, had been cast in the roles in the original production.
Right, right.
Next production, which I did not like.
Yeah.
And I'm very nice but clear that it was not the production I liked. Had two openly gay people play the role, but I don't believe they kissed. But they might have kissed. But I didn't like it, so I didn't care. Then came the third production, which was one that was along with what I wanted done, and I was more in charge of that production, or at least it had my ideas in it. And when I saw it, Doug Hodge and Kelsey Grammer, and they did kiss at the very end. There was a lovely kiss. I came to find out from the understudy that when they kissed, Kelsey Grammer actually slid his hand between the two mouths so that they wouldn't ever touch. And that Kelsey actually said to the understudy, if your lips touch mine, I will bring you up on charges. You know what I mean? Something as ridiculous as that. And, you know, which always struck me, you know, have a heterosexual actor play a gay role and they give them an Oscar. Gay people play straight roles all the time and nobody even notices. You know, we kiss women all the time and have no problem with it. But you ask two men to get it, you get all these problems.
So how about when you star in it?
Well, when I did it with Jeffrey Tambor first, we kissed. We actually kissed, but not a joyous kiss. Jeffrey Tambor is not a joyous kissing kind of guy. I mean, yeah. But anyway, Christopher Sieber, who took over the role, he and I, and we just had the best time. We not only kissed at that moment, but we would laugh. And, you know, sometimes we were on this staircase. We were sitting on a staircase and we'd sometimes roll down the staircase onto the floor laughing as the curtain came down. It was very obvious to the audience. These were two people who really had a great time together. And I think the photo I used in the book is of the two of us laughing, I think. I would have to guess. There it is.
Look at that. Isn't that beautiful?
It's the two of us laughing and dancing together.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? That is a change. That's a change from the first time.
Yes. And hopefully the next time too. You know, Lacage does grow over the years and does change over the years, which is kind of wonderful. You know, that's what theater should do. It's a living art. I know I love movies. You love movies. I love television. Whatever. They're dead because they are exactly the same now as they were 50 years ago. You can watch that same movie 50 years from now. The people can be dead. It's the same performance or whatever. It's not a living thing. It's a work of art like a painting, but it's dead. It's an object. It's not a living thing.
Yeah.
Theater is a living thing. Unless the people are alive on that stage. Though I've been with some actors, but usually, unless they're alive, you're not having.
I got two words for you that are going to make you so happy.
The end?
Oh, you're so awful. You're so awful to me, and I'm so nice to you. The two words are another clip.
Oh, fuck.
Hit it.
I am loved.
Do you recognize that?
That Ginger?
Yeah.
That Ginger Minch. Ginger's about to play it on stage. You know that? Oh, Ginger Minj. Yeah, go on Facebook or whatever and look up Ginger Minj.
Yeah.
You should tell your audience. That was a tribute to me.
You are helping me out here. Let me do that. So, also, when I play you clips, you look like you're trying to find the answer on Jeopardy. You're just looking around.
I am a huge Jeopardy fan. Don't you know that? I wrote to Amy. We wrote to each other. In fact, I said I couldn't be more proud of her if she was my own daughter.
Amy, the woman who won like a trillion like Jeopardies in a row. Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah. So we. And
you should have been the host. Did you go for the host?
Oh no, because I can't read. But I was a question on Jeopardy the other day.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did they get it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. It must suck to be a question on Jeopardy and no one get it right.
Oh, honey. The week before that. I show my kinky. The answer was, I forget what show it was. It was on Broadway musicals, and the answer was, I think, Dear Evan Hansen, but they guessed Kinky Boots.
That's pretty good.
So I ended up on the show, but it wasn't supposed to.
So that's Ginger Minj, the drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race, singing I Am What I Am from Le Cage aux Folles, from your musical, and she's serenading you at the Logo Trailblazers Honors in 2016. For someone who doesn't look back too often, it did feel like a full circle moment.
Because?
Didn't it? You seemed so affected by it. You seemed so moved by it.
Oh, I'm easily moved. But no, I love those drag queens. I love RuPaul's Drag Race. I've never appeared because I don't want to judge. And they've asked me to do it several times, and I absolutely adore it, but I'm not going to sit there and say, you are better than you. Those drag queens are so, and they're so different than drag queens of my day. I mean, we never had those gorgeous gowns, and the style of makeup, the style of wigs, the style of everything, and drag queens now are beyond, I'm trying to be this daring, frightening thing to... they're just these gorgeous creatures, these wonderful, fun, glorious, artistic creations that aren't sexually frightening to anybody. I don't see straight men running away from RuPaul's Drag Race. They watch RuPaul's Drag Race.
Well, that's what I meant by full circle, Harvey, is that it starts off as this thing that is...
But it's not full circle because it has nothing to do with what we were doing. It's a whole new thing. It's not... Full circle... To me, and maybe it's just that we use different words, to me means you end up in the place you began. You can't ever go backwards. We only move forwards. That's what's so tragic about those people with Trump and all that. Make America great again. You're dead. I want to be in the past. I have no ambition to move forward. I want to live in the past where it wasn't so scary. I didn't have to ask questions. I didn't have to do anything. I want to live in Mayberry RFD. I want to live in the Andy Griffith show. I want to live in Queen for a day. I don't want you frightening the hell out of me. And that's why those people, I look at them and my heart goes out to them because their lives will never be any good. You can buy a penny toy, you know, that your mother gave you a little whistle or whatever. And then you see this guy 70 years old walking through an antiques mall and he sees that whistle and he'll pay $50 for that penny whistle to have that moment of childhood back. And it's as sad as anything.
Yeah.
Just from a collector of old crap.
I know. I wasn't going to say it. I was looking back and going, there's some old stuff.
But this is all, no. Well, actually, the two big drawings you're looking at there are by Warhol. So, and one of them's of a drag queen who was in all my early shows, Wilhelmina Ross. So this stuff means something to me. But
that's the way to put it. Like selling like, you're right. Cause I think I don't buy a lot of antiques, but because I work in public radio.
You're not old enough yet.
Yeah, you're right.
You'll get that cookie.
Yeah. What do you learn about yourself now from looking back to write this book?
But you read the book because I opened the book by saying, look back, but don't stare.
I keep on telling you, I'm here to translate for the people who haven't read it yet.
They can't wait to read it because there's so much good shit in there.
Hold on, let me try this. I tell you this, you got to check out this book because it has so much sex and violence and celebrity stories and drugs.
And drugs. Yeah, there is some drugs in there.
Tell me, what did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about yourself writing this book?
I can tell you that when I read the book out loud, the thing that killed me. The only, and like I said, because I read so badly, it was a lot of concentration on reading. And when I got to the section where I talked about heterosexuals letting us die at AIDS, that's the one that killed me. So I thought that was interesting. When I read the other day, I had to read for the New York Public Library, the section, now you do a lot of these readings, these excerpt readings, and the stuff about celebrities is all just fun to read, you know. But when I read the section about this kid, Scott, that was put in conversion therapy, that sort of killed me. So this is so much truth in the book that means what it means to me. It doesn't matter what it means to me. I wrote the book already. It really matters. It really matters to me what it means to you. And like I said, the reaction so far has been so unbelievable that lovely.
I think this book is going to mean a lot to a lot of people. I really loved reading it. I love talking to you, too. Thanks for the time.
Oh, yeah, sure. I had nothing else to do.
I love how by the end of that conversation, it was just Harvey Fierstein making jokes about how... Well, I'll tell you this. We were making jokes about how we wanted it to be over. I will tell you, we stayed on the line for like 20, 25 minutes afterwards, just telling stories and yakking. And this is where it's fun to have this podcast. And this is where I think the joy is in subscribing to this podcast, because you're going to hear something that never made it onto air. So I was talking to Harvey, and at the end, I did this little back sell thing where I said, yeah, you'll see Harvey Fierstein. He's one of the producers of the new Funny Girl, the Barbara Streisand musical. And he stops me. He insists to me that Barbara had, quote, nothing to do with Funny Girl. I mean, I don't know if I fully agree with that. Anyway, this made me tell him what happened when I interviewed Barbara Streisand last summer. But even before we got on the line, we were going there, you know, just going, getting really deep about the idea of doing interviews. And then as soon as we started the interview, and by the way, I love this about her because you couldn't predict it. As soon as I start the actual interview, she just starts eating avocado toast. Anyway, I had to tell Harvey about it.
That's my Babs. So she is in a world of her own. I mean, I can tell you stories. I can't tell you because it's being taped, but I can tell you stories. But I will tell you one story that has to do with me that she doesn't know, which was when I was doing Torch Song, I had a live rabbit that lived in my dressing room. I think I said that. And she came to see the show, and she was wearing a full-length rabbit coat down to the floor. I think she knew that the rabbits were in there. Anyway, so she takes off the coat, she puts it on the couch, and the rabbit's running around the room, and the two of us are talking. And out of the corner of my eye, I see Arnold, the rabbit, eating her coat, biting a hole in the bottom of her coat, and I never told her. And I said to myself, she probably got home, because she's a perfectionist. She is the ultimate perfectionist. And she saw that, and she probably fucking goddamn cab driver, closed the door on my thing. And I've never let her know that my coat. And now you're going to tell her, and now I'm going to get a bill for that fucking coat.
You think she's ever going to talk to me again after I talk about her avocado toast?
Well, I could, like I said, I could tell
you. I bet you could.
All right, go live your life.
Thanks so much.
All right, you take care.
You too.
And get the hardcover. It's Deckle Edged.
Ooh. I went to school with a fellow named Deckle Edged. This is great. Thank you very much. That's a little bit of me telling Harvey Fierstein about Barbara Streisand. Harvey Fierstein's new memoir is called I Was Better Last Night. It is out now. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review, and send in your letters or questions to q@cbc.ca for this podcast. We'll see you next week. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.